I need to make a public confession. I made a mistake last week.
Only one. Only one I'm going to tell you about.
In Isaiah 16, I made a comment about the river Arnon. And if any of you, you probably don't even care about this, but I do. I mentioned about verse 2 about the fords of Arnon. And I made a statement that said, where I said that the Arnon was the border between the nations of Moab and Edom. Wrong. That's wrong. You know why I know it's wrong? Because this week in my quiet time, we're reading through the book of Numbers, and it says that the Arnon River is the boundary between the Moabites and the Amorites, which were eventually conquered by Israel, and it became a border between Moab and Israel. So I was wrong, so I apologize. I don't know where I got that information. I still haven't tracked down which commentary told me that. Anyway, so move on. We start in chapter 17, a new prophecy, a new burden. We're in the midst of these burdens. Some translations call them oracles, or they're prophecies. They're called burdens because, I mean, the Hebrew word could be translated burden because these are heavy things. These are heavy things. Sometimes when God speaks, it's a heavy thing. We can get the idea sometimes that God only speaks the fluffy, lovely, fun stuff. Well, I got news. Sometimes He hits us right in the heart, and he zeroes in. And sometimes it's hard stuff. These are the burdens. There does not seem to be a date associated with this burden. As you know, the book of Isaiah wasn't written. He didn't just sit down and write this thing out one chapter after another. This is a compilation of all his different stuff. We don't have a date attached to this one. It would seem that it would be one of his earlier prophecies because it seems to be talking about what will happen in the days of King Ahaz, which was in the beginning of his ministry. And then later, the reign of Hezekiah. We'll see all this stuff as we go through it. Verse 1. The burden of Damascus. Behold, Damascus is taken away from being a city, and it shall be a ruinous heap. Damascus. This is the same city. It's still around, Damascus. It's the capital of Syria. It's to the north and to the east of Israel. The Assyrian king, Tiglath-Pileser, conquered the Syrian capital of Damascus in the days of King Ahaz in 732 BC. He took many of the people captive and transplanted them in a far-off land. And he says here, behold, Damascus is taken away from being a city, and it shall be a ruinous heap. Now, though Damascus would be conquered by the Assyrians, later it would be conquered by the Babylonians again, by Nebuchadnezzar, it keeps being rebuilt over and over again. When it says that it'll be a ruinous heap, this is not like the prophecy we read in chapter 13 of Babylon, where it said that it would not be inhabited forever. Do you notice the word forever is missing here? It just says it will be a ruinous heap. It'd be wiped out, then they rebuild. Okay, it's not saying it still has to be a ruinous heap. It's a one-time, I mean, they get rebuilt over and over. Verse 2, the cities of Aroer are forsaken. The name of the city Aroer means ruin, and it's a city that's located on the eastern side of the Jordan in the tribe of Gad. The cities of Aroer are forsaken. They shall be for flocks which shall lie down, and none shall make them afraid. Now the concept here is this, that this group of cities would be devastated. They would be so depopulated, all the people would be gone. See, sheep are very skittish animals. They frighten easily. And so for sheep to lie down in the middle of a city and make it its home, there can't be a lot of people around. So that's the picture here, is that these cities are going to be ruined. They're going to be in heaps. And the sheep, they'll be grazing sheep there in the cities instead of out in the fields. Verse 3, the fortress also shall cease from Ephraim, and the kingdom from Damascus, and the remnant of Syria, they shall be as the glory of the children of Israel, saith the Lord of hosts. Now, a couple things. The fortress also shall cease from Ephraim. Ephraim is one of the tribes of Israel. They were located right in the middle of the main area of Israel. They were the main tribe of the northern kingdom. And in fact, usually, and I believe here, when we see the name Ephraim, it's not just talking about the tribe. The name Ephraim is often used to describe the northern kingdom. The northern kingdom is called Israel. It's referred to as Samaria, which is the capital of the city. It is also called Ephraim, which was the main tribe. And so it says, the fortress also shall cease from Ephraim. We know back from when we were back in Isaiah 7 and 8, that the northern kingdom of Israel, remember, the kingdom of Israel had been split into two and had a civil war. There was the southern kingdom called Judah, and the northern kingdom kept the name of Israel. The northern kingdom had been in alliance. They had been allies with the Syrians. See, I'm doing it backwards for you. Israel and the Syrians. The Syrians or the nation of Aram, they had been in alliance with each other and had been attacking Judah. Do you remember that? And how God was encouraging Ahaz, it's going to be okay, I'm going to take care of you. Those two had been in alliance. So see here, as we're talking about this burden of Damascus, which is the capital of Syria, all of a sudden the thing slips into talking about Ephraim, about the northern kingdom. It says the fortress will depart from you. There won't be any more fortified cities. In other words, these people are going to be wiped out. The enemy will have come in and taken away all their defenses. They'll have had all those little laser-guided bombs hitting all of their anti-aircraft sites and things like that. See, their defenses will be gone. It says, the fortress shall cease from Ephraim, the kingdom from Damascus. Again, Damascus, the capital of Syria. They're going to lose their nation. And the remnant of Syria, they shall be as the glory of the children of Israel, saith the Lord of hosts. The children of Israel, their glory is going downhill. In Isaiah, don't think of this as, oh, they're going to be the glory of Israel. No, no, no. See, Israel's glory has been going down. In fact, they're on the way out. They're on the way out. And so the idea, this is all, if you understand the historical context, this is all pretty sad stuff. It's all pretty sad stuff. Verse 4, and in that day it shall come to pass that the glory of Jacob shall be made thin, and the fatness of his flesh shall wax lean or grow lean. The glory of Jacob. I believe this is talking about the northern kingdom. The northern kingdom was the bigger part of the split. When the split happened, the northern kingdom had 10 tribes. The southern kingdom only kept 2 of them. Syria would be wiped out by the Assyrians in 732 BC. 10 years later, the northern kingdom of Israel will be totally wiped out. They'll all be carried off. Now, as I was thinking about this, if you notice, we started in verse 1 talking about the burden of what? Damascus. And as you'll see, from verse 4 on, it's all talking about the northern kingdom. You'll see that as we go along. He from verse 4, he's talking about the northern kingdom, and at that point on, he never changes the subject. There is a sense in which this northern kingdom will be judged for their own sins. But as I'm reading this, I can't help but think that part of the judgment they're facing is because they're getting caught up in Damascus. They're getting caught up because of their alliance with Damascus. See, the prophecy is against Damascus, but you know what? Damascus and the northern kingdom are like this. I mean, like, they're tight buds. They kind of hang together. They you know, Friday nights they go out for coffee together, you know, and they like to go over each other's house and do stuff, hang out together, you know. And when the judgment comes against Damascus, guess who gets pulled into it? Israel, the northern kingdom. The warning is this: be careful who you join yourself to. Be careful who you join yourself to. The Bible warns us in 2 Corinthians 6:14, "Be ye not unequally yoked together with unbelievers. For what fellowship hath righteousness with unrighteousness? What communion hath light with darkness? And what concord, what agreement has Christ with Satan? Or what part hath he that believeth with an unbeliever? And what agreement hath the temple of God with idols? For you are the temple of the living God. As God has said, I will dwell in them and walk in them and will be their God, and they shall be my people." See, Paul's warning in 2 Corinthians 6 is against developing the kinds of relationships with unbelievers. And you know what? I would even dare say with backslidden Christians. The kinds of relationships where they influence you. Now, don't misunderstand me. This doesn't mean that we aren't to have relationships, any kind of a relationship with unbelievers. Oh no, just the opposite. No, God wants you to develop relationships with unbelievers. How are they going to know about Jesus? How are they going to know whether your message is true if they don't see it in your life? But you know what, gang? There are times where your relationship, my relationship with an unbeliever, isn't such that I'm trying to win them to the Lord. No, I just want to be loved, accepted by them, you know? And I just want to be cool like they are. And the problem is that when they go down, you're going with them. It's one thing to be reaching out to a drug dealer and witnessing to him about Jesus. But when he's your roommate and he gets busted, guess who goes to jail too? See what I'm saying? In the book of Genesis, Abraham's nephew, Lot, got himself into trouble because he got a little too close to the wildlife. Abraham and Lot were living together for a long time. They had all their flocks and everything together, but they got to a point where they were just so prosperous they had to split up, or else the land couldn't take care of all of them. And so they split up, and Abraham, being so generous, he said to his young nephew, he said, "Lot, you know, you take first pick. You know, you go wherever you want, bud." And Lot looked around. They were up on top of a mountain. He looks around and he sees the Jordan Valley. And he goes, "Well, that's a cool place. I'm heading down there." And so the next thing we know, we see Lot heading down towards the Jordan Valley, towards the city of Sodom and Gomorrah. And it says that he knew that they were a wicked place. As you read on, you get to chapter 14, Lot isn't just living outside of Sodom. Now he's moved into the city. A place that he knows is a place of great wickedness. And when five kings from far away come to conquer Sodom, guess who gets carried off with everyone else? Lot. Has to be rescued by Uncle Abe. He's got to get bailed out. Does he learn his lesson? Oh no. Oh no. In fact, as you read on in chapter 19 of Genesis, if I'm understanding what Moses is writing correctly, if I'm understanding this, Lot is not just living in Sodom, but now he's one of the leaders of Sodom. He's sitting in the gate of the city. That's where the elders sat. That's where the courts had kept. That's where they did judgment, court stuff. And it's not like he was like, well, I'm going to change this government. I'm going to bring revival to Sodom. No. In fact, nobody took him seriously. When it came time to leave, he speaks to his sons-in-laws, future sons-in-laws, and says, you know, guys, two angels showed up and they say we got to leave. And it says they thought he was just telling them jokes, probably like he always used to. Lot is rescued from Sodom and Gomorrah, but he loses everything that he has except his daughters. Lost his wife, lost everything else. Be careful who you join yourself to. Bad company corrupts good morals. And so here, as this prophecy is proceeding on, it starts off towards Damascus and then it veers off towards Israel. Verse 5. And it shall be as when the harvest man gathereth the corn and reapeth the ears with his arm, and it shall be as he that gathereth ears in the valley of Rephaim. Now what he's talking about is he's talking about when the northern kingdom is conquered and they're carried away. It will be just like it says the Valley of Rephaim. Rephaim means giants, so I guess it's the Valley of the Giants. It was a fertile valley just outside of Jerusalem, where the corn was as high as an elephant's eye, and oh, what a beautiful And the idea is this. Is that just as in the Valley of Rephaim, where the wheat's growing all over, and the harvesters, they're grabbing the grain in around their arm, taking a sickle with the other arm and chopping it off as they're harvesting huge armloads of grain. That's the picture of the northern kingdom getting grabbed and carried off. They're going to be harvested in judgment. Verse 6. Yet gleaning grapes shall be left in it, as the shaking of an olive tree, two or three berries in the top of the uppermost bough, four or five in the outmost fruitful branches thereof, saith the Lord God of Israel. You writers, if you've noticed, they're mixing their metaphors. We're talking about grain, we're talking about grapes, we're talking about olives. Hey, keep the fruit straight here. The point is this, gleaning grapes. Israel was instructed by God through Moses that when they were to harvest their field, they weren't supposed to get every little nook and cranny and just make those fields totally bare and get every little thing you can out of the ground. In fact, as they're going through the fields, they were supposed to leave stuff so that the poor people of the land could come in and what they call is gleaning. They would come in and pick up the leftovers. The things, the little shoots here and there that hadn't been harvested. And so the picture is, again, as Israel is being harvested in judgment and carried off, there will be some left for gleaning. In other words, a small remnant of people will be left in the land. Verse 7. At that day shall a man look to his Maker, and his eyes shall have respect to the Holy One of Israel. And he shall not look to the altars, the work of his hands, neither shall respect that which his fingers have made, either the groves or the images. What Isaiah is saying is that there will be a turning back to God in the time of judgment. Be a wake-up call. And they'll pay attention. He says, there shall be no respect of... he shall not look to the altars, the work of his hands. Talking about the altars to foreign gods all over the place. you know, the northern kingdom of Israel, and went after every little god that came along, every new thing that came along. It says, no, that which his fingers have made, talking about the idols, either the groves, the Hebrew word is Asherah, these were wooden figurines carved in honor of and in worship of a female goddess. Pornographic stuff. It says they'll get rid of this stuff. And the images, the word that's used there is talking about images to the sun god, which was Baal. Kind of like the boyfriend of Ashtaroth. They'll get rid of it all. New Living Translation says they will no longer ask their idols for help or worship what their own hands have made. They will never again bow down to their Asherah poles or burn incense on the altars they built. Sometimes God uses difficult times to wake us up, doesn't he? You know, the downhill slide goes gradually, doesn't it? You know, it's not like, man, we're just baptized in the Holy Spirit, walking with Jesus, hallelujah, amen. And the next day, boom, I'm in the gutter and I'm, you know, snorting coke and whatever, you know. It doesn't work like that, does it? You know, we walk with the Lord, things are going great, and then the next day, we're still walking with the Lord, you know. And the next day, we're still walking with the Lord. And the next day, I'm still walking with the Lord. And on it goes, and just a little bit less. Kind of let it go. Little things sneak back into our lives here and there. No need for that. Sometimes God in His love will send difficult times, a harvest of judgment, to wake us up and come back to Him. It's not because He's angry or mad at you. It's because He loves you. He doesn't want you in that place. Verse 9, in that day shall His strong cities be as a forsaken bough and an uppermost branch which they left because of the children of Israel, and there shall be desolation. In other words, just a few stuff left. You know, all the strong cities are just the stuff that the harvesters couldn't get in the olive trees. Verse 10. Because thou hast forsaken the God of thy salvation and hast not been mindful of the rock of thy strength. Therefore shalt thou plant pleasant plants and shalt set it in strange slips. I'm going to have to cut this verse in half. The reason, again, this judgment is coming is because thou hast forgotten the God of thy salvation and hast not been mindful of the rock of thy strength. Then he starts a new idea, and he says, therefore shalt thou plant pleasant plants and shalt set it with strange slips. In the day shalt thou make thy plant to grow, and in the morning shalt thou make thy seed to flourish. But the harvest shall be a heap in the day of grief and of desperate sorrow. Again, the New Living Translation says this in verse 10. It says, at the end of it, it says, you may plant the finest imported grapevines. And then going into verse 11, and they may grow so well that they blossom on the very morning you plant them. But you will never pick any grapes from them. Your only harvest will be a load of grief and incurable. When you're away from God, nothing satisfies. Hard times can come and I'll try something new.
I'll get the latest grapevines. I got them. They got them down at Home Depot. Just got them in. You know, our crops have failed. You know, and well, it's okay. We can handle this. You know, we'll try something new, and I'll try a little bit of this, and I'll try a little bit of that. And you know what? Nothing satisfies when you're away from the Lord. Sometimes we're trying our best to forget God. We turn to all sorts of things to take away the pain. It may be that we try drugs, alcohol, or sex to take away the pain. Maybe we just try going on a special vacation or just go out to dinner to get away from it all. And you know what? Sometimes these things look pretty promising. And there seems to be a little measure of, that feels pretty good. But you know what? The emptiness comes right back, doesn't it? You know what I'm talking about? When we've got that emptiness inside, haven't been right with God, and I try filling it with all kinds of different things, a new computer, a new upgrade, you know, and all these kind of things. And you know what? You get a little jazz for a minute. And then you know what? You're still empty. Only Jesus can fill the emptiness. Do you believe that? Only Jesus can fill the emptiness. I mean, think about it, gang. I think sometimes I'm not so sure I believe it. By the way I act. Only Jesus can fill the emptiness. You and I were created with a very special purpose in mind, to be able to know and enjoy God. And when we're trying to fill that emptiness by running around here, running around there, if I just have this relationship over here, if I can just get this job, if I can just get this promotion, you know. No. You and I were created to enjoy and to know God. When sin comes into the picture, that ability to relate to God is broken. The only way to mend the brokenness is to do something about the sin. It's not just a matter of stopping the sin, though that's important. It's a matter of paying the price for the sin that's required. And that's why Jesus came to the earth to die on a cross. He died to pay the penalty of our sin. He died and experienced hell so that we wouldn't have to. And when we turn to Him and ask for His forgiveness, the break between us and God is mended. It's only at that point, when we're coming to Jesus and asking for His forgiveness and turning away from our sin, that we begin to taste the sweetness, the fullness that God has for us. We're going to end the service in a few minutes and have communion. And before we have communion, I'm going to give you a chance. Maybe you've been running the wrong direction, and I'm going to give you a chance to get things right and to taste that sweetness. But let's move on. I want to finish the chapter. We'll come back. Verse 12. We start a new theme. We've been talking about the destruction of Israel, and now he's going to switch and focus on the group that's going to try to destroy Israel. Okay? To the Assyrians. Verse 12. Woe to the multitude of many people, which make a noise like the noise of the seas and the rushing of nations, that make a rushing like the rushing of mighty waters. The nation shall rush like the rushing of many waters, but God shall rebuke them. And they shall flee far off, and shall be chased as the chaff of the mountains before the wind, and like a rolling thing before the whirlwind. Now, the chase is the chaff. When you would harvest wheat, you have to break up the grains and break off the husk, the chaff that's around the grain, and then you go to the threshing floor and you toss the stuff up in the air, and
threshing floor is usually up on a high place where there's a lot of wind, and the wind would carry the chaff away and the grain falls. And so the idea is that this nation, that these people that will be coming against them, will be just blown away. God will rebuke them and they'll go away. It says, as a rolling thing before the whirlwind, you know, just as a wind comes and just blows stuff around, these people will be blown away. And behold, at evening tide, trouble. But before the morning, he is not. I mean, we'll be all worried, biting our nails, you know, as we're going to bed. But in the morning, they're all gone. This is a description of what happened to the Assyrians when they came against Jerusalem. Remember, the army had surrounded Jerusalem, and Hezekiah told the people, "Just trust God, trust Him. He's going to be okay. He's going to take care of it." And in the morning, they woke up, and 185,000 Assyrians were dead. In the morning, he is not. This is the portion of them that spoil us and the lot of them that rob us. Let me just end with two points here. One is this. God can take care of the biggest enemy. You see the description, nations rushing like many waters. You know you've ever sat by a mountain river after the snows and the water just crashing down the rocks and all the roar and the thunder and this powerful, mighty, awesome enemy. No nation has stood against the Assyrians. And here they are right on your doorstep, Hezekiah. You know what? It's nothing to God. That's it. Just, they're gone. He only had to send one angel.
Oh man, 185,000 Assyrians, I don't know if I can handle that.
Fred, will you go take care of that? Just one angel. God can take care of the biggest enemy. Sometimes our problems can seem pretty big. There were some backwoods hillbillies living across the river from each other who feuded constantly. John hated Clarence with a passion and never passed up a chance to throw rocks across the river at Clarence. This went on for years until one day the Corps of Engineers came to build a bridge across that river. John was elated. He told his wife that finally he was going to get the chance to cross over and whoop Clarence. He left the house and returned in a matter of minutes. His wife asked what was wrong. Didn't he intend to go over the bridge and whoop Clarence? He replied that he never had really seen Clarence up close and didn't realize his size until he started over the bridge and saw the sign. Clarence, 8 feet, 3 inches. Sometimes our enemies seem awfully big. And you know what? Sometimes they are. Young David faced Goliath, who was 9 feet, 6 inches. Armed to the teeth. And all he's got is a little pouch of stones and a sling. And he ran to Goliath when he saw him. It's not up to the size of the enemy, it's the size of your God. It's not the size of your enemy, it's the size of your God. David said, "You come to me with the spear and the shield, but I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts." And it wasn't even like he had this really big guy standing next to him. He said, "I just come to you in the name." That's all it took. Against a 9-foot giant, trained from youth as a warrior. God can take care of the biggest enemy. The biggest enemy. And the last thing, look at the end of verse 14. It says, well, verse 14, "Behold, at evening tide, trouble, before the morning he is not. This is the portion of them that spoil us, and the lot of them that rob us. In other words, Isaiah is saying, look, this is what's going to happen to people who come against us. Isaiah will write in chapter 54, verse 17, no weapon that is formed against thee shall prosper, and every tongue that shall rise against thee in judgment thou shalt condemn. This is the heritage of the servants of the Lord, and their righteousness is of me, said the Lord. It may not always happen like the Assyrians. It may not happen that tomorrow all of your guys will be dead outside around your house. It may not always happen that way, you know. It may take days, it may take weeks, it may take years, but you know what? God cares about his own. He looks out for his own.